Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you a little bit about some of the research we've been doing and kind of give a lead in for the next two speakers who are going to go more into detail relative to some of the opportunities we have to actually improve animal health. And as you'll see as we go through this, I'm pretty excited about some of the research and very enthusiastic about the opportunities we have in this class of traits. So with that said, you know, I think it's pretty obvious to everybody in the room why we're interested in animal health, what we stand to gain. We stand to reduce our costs of production, right? And if we can reduce our costs of production, we're going to be hopefully more profitable. I think it was Willie this morning said they're paying their cowboy, bringing those lower cattle by him, $150 a month. Okay? Our labor costs are clearly a lot more expensive than that. But we have some other opportunities where we can actually make some permanent genetic change and increase our profitability. So if we reduce cost of production, we're going to do that through obviously lower treatment rates and the costs associated with that, hopefully lower mortality rates. And then even for animals you've treated and recovered, typically there's some poor performance that may be made up. There's some evidence for compensatory gain on animals that have been sick and then recovered, provided you're feeding them long enough. But clearly there's some costs associated with animal health and our approaches to that. And our approaches to that have been primarily from a management standpoint. We look at how we handle those animals. We want to do low-stress weaning, low-stress handling, right? Keep those cattle calm when you load them in the truck. And we've preconditioned those. We've vaccinated. And on arrival in the feedlot, we may try to implement some new methodologies for early detection of sick animals or prophylaxis, right? Or we're medicating every animal coming in because they're high risk. We're going to give them all a dose of antibiotics to try to prevent disease. And most of our approaches have been on that from that standpoint, on how do we manage those. So I would call those environmental approaches or an environmental approach to how we improve animal health. And largely, at least for the majority of our issues, we've kind of ignored genetics, right? How could we actually select animals that have better health? Realizing that there's probably some interaction between genetics and environment when we look at health, right? And we're going to have to account for some of those things. And if you look at this from a big genetic evaluation standpoint, the low-hanging fruit, we've got those picked, right? We've been eating on those for 40 years. I think it was Robert Williams showed the first sire summary, 1971. We've had EPDs for birth weight, weaning weight, milk, yearling weight for 40 years, right? We've been using those. Carcass traits, what, 25 years, 20 years? Then more recently, calving ease, fertility. And many of you would argue whether we've actually got a good handle on fertility or not, and that's some of the topics later this afternoon in our subcommittees. And other cow traits. And that's been especially we've been enabled due to total herd reporting as far as being able to evaluate those traits and actually make and deliver some good selection tools for you as breeders to use when you choose which bulls to AI to or which bulls you're going to purchase at a bull sale. But there's this other class of traits that aren't low-hanging, right? They're economically relevant, meaning if we change those, we're going to change our profitability, but they're hard to evaluate. And so we start to think of those. I mean, we had talked about feed efficiency or feed intake. No matter how you express it, we may not all agree on how we produce those EPDs or what units they're expressed as, right? But it's a hard to evaluate trait, but clearly there's some economic importance to that. And I would put health in that class as well, as far as an economically relevant trait. It's probably going to be hard to evaluate, but there is some opportunity to improve the profitability of production. So I look at cattle health. And I'm going to address it, and a lot of the veterinarians may not agree with the way I've classified disease cases, okay? But if you look at the single gene defect cases, right, or defects that are controlled by relatively few locations on the bovine chromosome, and I would argue that we've made overwhelming success in identifying carrier animals through the DNA marker tests we've been able to develop. And make no bones about it, I mean, we're going to have new single defect problems in the future, somewhere down the line, right? That's the nature of DNA. We get mutations, and we may not find those right away. But with the knowledge we have now, we're able to develop relatively rapidly DNA tests to help us identify carriers and get those out of our population. So I'd say that's been a good example of selection where we've actually improved animal welfare or disease. And then there's this other class of traits that really aren't transmittable, but are a function of our environment. And I'm going to talk about one of those later on. But if you put in that, you know, last year BIF was in Missouri, we have fescue toxicity issues. I worked a couple years in New Zealand. They had facial eczema problems where the animals on the forage ingested a fungus and it caused metabolic disorders in the animals. Then we have high altitude disease, which I'm going to use later on as an example, where there has been some success from a genetic improvement standpoint, but there's still a ways to go. And then finally, if we look at the vector-related diseases, or those diseases, if you will, that are caused by a virus, a bacteria, or some parasite, something associated with a pathogen, right? Really, have we made any genetic improvement in that, other than through natural selection, where the ones that are poor are probably going to get cull themselves from the herd, right? But if we think about that, have we really tried to make improvement in those traits from a, we're going to select this animal because it's going to be more healthy standpoint? Okay, so I'm going to give you some of the preliminary results from a study we have going that is looking at vector-related diseases. So our impediment to genetic progress in a lot of these cases has been an absence of selection tools. And when I talk about selection tools, I'm talking particularly about EPDs, right? Some tool that allows you as breeders to select the bull that's going to produce progeny that are more healthy or more resistant to an environmental challenge. And that's primarily a function of the fact that it's hard to evaluate, so it's hard to get good data. We have a lack in many cases of good base knowledge about our health traits, and a lack of focus. And clearly, with the subject of the next 2 days in at least half of each of the general sessions, we've got more focus in that area relative to animal health. So if you look at the economically important traits, the traits that I would say generally fall in the area of health, we're looking at health and well-being, feed requirements, fertility, things that are more, if you will, adaptability traits, I would call those, okay? Especially on the cow level for feed requirements or maintenance requirements. So we want to look at that from the health, from the general perspective of adaptability. And what I'm going to talk about is adaptability to the cow-calf environment, and then when we talk about pathogen-associated diseases, adaptability in the feedlot. And our challenges with disease traits have generally been, can we make a good diagnosis? When the pen rider pulled that calf, was it really for respiratory disease, or is there something else going on? And what is the utility of data? All of you breeders, you've all treated calves, and we may not have submitted that data to anywhere. We may have kept it on our own computer. If you're a feedlot operator, you've got to track withdrawal times for drugs, right? What's the utility of our treatment data across the variety of production environments just represented in this room? And then when you get a pen of calves and you pull a few, were actually all of the calves in that pen equally exposed to the disease-causing pathogen? That's another issue associated with disease traits. So if you look at the general process for developing selection tools or EPDs, the first thing we do in any process is what is the economically relevant trait, or what are the economically relevant traits? So those traits, again, that if you change those, you're actually going to change your profitability. That's what I'm calling economically relevant traits. The second step is to determine, are these things you want to improve actually have some genetic control? That is their heritability not zero? Do we have something we can work with as far as genetic variability to actually make improvement? And then finally, remember I'm talking about the hard to evaluate traits. Are there indicators that we can measure more easily and actually make improvement in the trait we're really interested in improving? And this is the same thing we did when we started looking at how do we improve carcass quality. Right? Carcass measures, getting that data back from the packer originally was problematic. Right? We didn't get much of that information back on sire-identified cattle. So what did we do? We went out and said, there's a technology out there we can develop in ultrasound to use that as an indicator of end progeny, carcass quality, carcass yield, carcass weight. Okay? So we use indicator traits, same type of process in developing indicators. Using a tool that is really related to what we want to improve, there is a strong genetic correlation. And then can we collect field data? Okay. Or Are DNA marker tests more appropriate and cost-effective, or do we really need both pieces of information? And I would argue with the feed efficiency work or feed intake work that we currently have going on in a multiple locations across the U.S., the volume of data we will ever get in for feed intake relative to what we get for birth weight and weaning weight and yearling weight is much smaller. Okay? So we need to leverage that data, find good indicators, and find good markers for how we can actually select animals that are going to help us make progress in that area. And if the above is successful, you go through that process whenever we're developing new traits, we're going to have a good tool that allows us to actually make genetic improvement in our beef cattle population. So going back to the three classes, there's two I want to talk about in giving an opportunity or giving an overview of potential for genetic improvement of animal health. And the first one I want to talk about is the non-transmittable environmental challenges in the form of high altitude disease or brisket disease, as many of you would have heard it called more commonly. And then we're going to talk about bovine respiratory disease a little bit. Okay. So starting with the non-transmittable disease, high altitude disease or brisket disease. Just a little background for those of you who are from lower elevations, what this disease is. It's usually manifest about above 5,500 feet of elevation, and you typically see, hence the name brisket disease, a swollen brisket area. The animals have a reduced appetite or potentially, if they're on a bull test, go off feed. You know, it's a general poor doer if you're out riding through your cows and looking at the calves. And eventually it's going to cause death due to heart failure. Physiologically, because, you know, if you go to higher elevations, we don't have as much oxygen, the animal tries to compensate with that, and the heart responds by being more forceful and pumping blood through the pulmonary system or the lung system. It forces fluid out, and you get the swollen brisket, and eventually you get heart valve damage and death. Okay? And in native cattle or native cattle to high elevation, you don't see this a lot. You see it. But for those stocker operations who are bringing in yearlings to run on summer grass, sometimes the incidence can be as high as 50%. Okay? And then you've got a problem. All right. So if you look at that, what we want to do is select the genetics or select the bulls that produce those offspring that are high elevation that are going to survive. Now we're going to call that the economically relevant trait. The problem is, you know, most of those animals are at high elevation, very extensive environment. Getting a good identification of afflicted animal, unless you just happen to see it, or you've got a bull test at high elevation, is problematic. Okay, so identifying those is problematic. So what we did is actually the veterinarians, Dr. Tim Holt, one of those at Colorado State University, developed a measure where we could actually predict susceptibility to brisket disease, and it was pulmonary arterial pressure. And what they do is they run a catheter actually through the jugular to the heart into the pulmonary artery, take a pressure reading, takes about 30 seconds, 45 seconds, and you get a measurement. Okay? The question is, right, is there variability in that? And based on a couple of the populations we've looked at from a genetic standpoint, pedigreed populations, there is variability. The heritability is about 40 to 46% for that value. Okay, so let's for those of you who aren't familiar with the term heritability says if we took everybody in this room and we took your height, right, and we adjusted for sex differences, difference between male and females, what proportion of the differences we see is due to genetics? Right? Hip height in cattle, what, 50% genetic? So very heritable. Same type of thing for pulmonary arterial pressure, a very heritable trait that should respond to selection. Okay? With that as an indicator for whether animals are actually going to succumb to this disease, I want to show you some of the results where we actually had an EPD with one cooperator herd and actually one of our own research herds at Colorado State that started using this. Okay? And as you're going to figure out, the university was slow on the uptake, whereas the private producer, the commercial producer, actually figured it out a lot quicker. So in 1992, Tybar Angus Ranch on the west slope of Colorado, who's about 7,500 feet of elevation, came to Dr. Jim Brinks, one of my mentors, and said, we've got all this high altitude disease information. Is there something we can do to actually make genetic progress? So in 1992, they had their first EPDs, and you see what happened immediately. We started getting downward pressure on downward selection pressure on PAP, or pulmonary arterial pressure, and started making progress, which is what you would expect when you have a trait that is under so much genetic control. And they've actually reduced their death loss significantly from the 1990s until the present and continue to put good downward pressure. And I guess I should probably fail to mention a lower PAP score is better if you're going to be at high elevation. At the Beef Improvement Center, we just started using the same technology in 2006. So we've kind of focused on our customers rather than ourselves, and we've got downward pressure as well. So selection works when you've got a tool to actually evaluate that. The problem with this, and as many of you who have dealt with the disease know, it's that arterial pressure has to be measured at high elevation after the animal has acclimatized, and typically we're looking at about 30 days. All right, so there's huge costs associated with that. And that's typical of a lot of the environmental caused disease traits like fescue toxicity. We can't look at animal differences if we're not in a fescue environment. Same type of thing in high altitude adaptability. So there's limits on our ability to accurately select animals that are low elevation or come from low elevation. So the solutions are we need to find indicator traits if we're going to really evaluate the whole population on a nationwide basis and or develop good tests to screen those animals before we use them in AI programs or buy bulls from low elevation to take them to high elevation. Okay, so we can get a greater proportion of calves surviving to weaning. All right? So those two pieces are still under development. But even with the one indicator and a limited set of data, there are opportunities to make actual improvement in susceptibility to that disease. Okay, so I'm going to switch from that example relative to the ability to make improvement and look at pathogen-associated diseases. And if you look at this, I got to give credit to one of my graduate students, Chase McAllister. My other graduate students would argue he is much more colorful than I am relative to preparation of slides, and I probably wouldn't have used all of the pictures of pathogen loads. But if you think about the environment, okay, you think about the pathogen load that we actually have when you ship calves to a feedlot, and if we think about conceptually how that works, as that pathogen load increases. We've got three different animals here. We go from a healthy animal to a diseased animal, right? And in reality, if we're trying to make genetic improvement, what we're trying to do is select that animal that even under a heavy pathogen load, okay, is not going to succumb or not show clinical signs of disease. And there is variability for this in most species. Okay? So how do we capitalize on that? And again, just to review, we've got some problems associated with those because when you put animals in a feedlot, are they all equally exposed? Okay. In the trial I'm going to tell you a little bit about, we had one pen of animals which was next to the feedlot's sick pen, right? And we had another pen of animals that was about half a mile down the alley, right, and not next to a sick pen. Well, clearly we've got differences in exposure just amongst the pens. The other issues are, do those cowboys actually make the correct diagnosis? And we're going to base our results off exactly that. The pen riders, when they pull an animal and treat it, we're going to use that as our phenotypic data, if you will. Then are there differences in severity? Clearly, we've probably got some subclinical cases we don't identify, and that comes from natural selection. You know, if you're a wildebeest in Africa and you've got lions chasing the herd, you don't want to be the one that looks sick, right? So, because they're headed for you. So we have some natural selection going on in animals that probably have bovine respiratory disease, but may not be symptomatic when the pen riders go through. And then, of course, do we have different responses relative to the causative pathogens? Okay. Going back to the economic relevance, clearly if you look at the majority of literature, susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease or the industry-wide costs associated with respiratory disease in our feedlot industry is pretty substantial. And Griffin in 97 looked at just the cost of prevention and treatment. No death loss, just prevention and treatment. Over $3 billion we spend. In 2005, we lost 1.1 million cattle to respiratory disease. And that comes from a NAMS survey, National Animal Health Monitoring System. And then Gary Snoder with the Meat Animal Research Center data looked at animals that were treated in the feedlot once in the first 40 days on feed relative to animals that were never treated, and we lost about 22 pounds in hot carcass weight. So there's some economic importance there. So if we look at this from the standpoint is we really want a tool that's going to reduce our animals' susceptibility to bovine respiratory disease. Okay? We want to go through that process I outlined earlier relative to do we have genetic variability. So I'm going to give you some really brief results from a study we've conducted or are conducting at Colorado State University. It's been funded by Pfizer Animal Genetics. And trying to characterize why animals get sick or the genetic basis for why some animals get sick in the same pen and some others don't. And hopefully, clearly, it's probably pretty obvious, if we can get some good markers for that, we can actually make some improvement in health. And as we'll see, there's another approach to leverage some of our phenotypic data in the future. Real quickly, one of the problems with health traits is 1 year you have a wreck, the next year you actually do pretty well. And if you look at our first year in the feedlot, we treated about 45% of those animals for respiratory disease at least once. Second year, we treated 7%, right? Well, in a wreck, and again, our outcome was whether that animal was actually pulled out of the pen and actually treated for respiratory disease. In a wreck, what are the cowboys going to do? What are the pen riders going to do? They're going to err on the safe side, right? You're going to pull a little deeper, right? Try to get a handle on that. Okay, so there's some noise associated with those higher treatment rates. In year two, we didn't have the same problems. Same group of calves, same ranch. So the question is, again, going to our process, is there actually genetic variability for this? So if we just look at those calves, and there was just under 3,000 calves, and we look at just a yes-no, kind of like a pregnancy analysis. She's either pregnant or she's not, right? Treated or not. We look at that and we get about 17% heritability. All right, so that says 17% of the differences amongst why animals are treated are due to additive genetics, meaning we can use that to actually make genetic progress. And everybody goes, well, geez, that's not very good. Your heritability of PAP was 40% and mature size is 40%. But let me put this in perspective. This is more heritable than heifer pregnancy, which we have EPDs for in most of the breeds we work with, and for milk production in some of the breeds that we work with at the CSU Center for Genetic Evaluation of Livestock. Okay? Now, if we took that one step further and actually said, let's forget just being treated for bovine respiratory disease based on the typical clinical signs, what if we look at animals that were treated for any reason? And the reason we did this is because some of the veterinarians we've worked with, you know, you get a higher incidence of bloat when you've treated more animals for respiratory disease. And you get some animals that bloat that were never treated for respiratory disease. So if we look at that, just whether an animal was pulled from the pen and treated for anything, we see that we actually have 24% heritability for that characteristic, which tells me there are some genetic differences in those animals' ability to cope with the environmental challenges, the pathogen-associated challenges in the feedlot. So that's pretty encouraging from the standpoint of actually we have some opportunities in the future to actually make genetic improvement. So going through this process, thinking about what we've done, what are the economically relevant traits? Well, the two were susceptibility to high-altitude disease and then bovine respiratory disease. Specifically for bovine respiratory disease, we had to establish, is there some genetic differences amongst animals relative to their ability to cope with that feedlot environment and that disease stressors? The next thing is, are there indicators that we can measure more easily? I mean, what we're looking at now is just whether an animal's treated or not. We need some flow back from the feedlot relative to our breed associations to actually collect that data. Okay? And then also to use that to develop good marker tests so we can actually, at the seed stock level, use that to make an informed selection decision. Okay? And I see this as the starting point. I mean, think about if we had the opportunity, all you cow-calf producers were just coming out of calving, if we had some methodology or some tool to select animals where we're going to treat less of our calves for scours. I know in one of our herds we had pretty severe treatment rate for calf scours. We vaccinate, right? But there's probably some genetic differences there, and we can actually improve our profitability. But the question is, can we get the data? And then are DNA marker tests more appropriate? So we're at the phase we're in for the bovine respiratory disease, we're looking at indicators that we might measure more easily. And we're looking at this from the standpoint of animal stress factors, so animal temperament, and immune factors. So how they respond to various challenges, what are their immune levels, what are their serum levels for various pathogens, and looking at genetic differences to try to predict whether an animal is actually going to get sick or not. So my challenge to you, Michael and Eric are going to talk more about some of the more focused genetic differences for animal health. But my challenge to you is we've got a lot of carcass progeny tests going out there in this room. And we've got a lot of feedlot operators. The idea is if we can eventually get some of that data back, we may have the opportunity to actually select animals that are going to stay healthier. And if you look at this from a consumer standpoint, you know, we get a lot of heat for antibiotic use. Whether that's right or wrong, that's consumer perception. What if we could say we're actually improving animal health through selection? I think that would be a win-win for us in terms of profitability and consumer perception. So our approach has been, can we actually, and I think the approach in the future is going to be, use that phenotypic information that's flowing back. I mean, if we're in a carcass progeny test, we have to follow those animals all the way to harvest. We have to know drug withdrawal time. So we know, you know, which of your steers got treated or which of your cull heifers got treated. Combine that eventually with good DNA information. Again, this is at the seed stock level. We're keeping those yearling bulls. They're not going to the commercial feedlot, right? Kind of like we're using ultrasound. And can we combine those to actually come up with a good selection tool to help us improve animal health? And I think the evidence is there, at least from a quantitative side, that we actually have genetic variability for some of the health traits. So the other thing I will point out is that we've got the evidence that we've got differences amongst those animals. You know, there's still some steps we need to take to actually make some successful or some very some accurate selection tools. But again, it comes down to the economic importance. And in that vein, I encourage you to come listen to tomorrow morning's session if you're thinking of leaving, because Allison Van Inenam is going to talk about precisely that relative to the value of selecting for resistance to bovine respiratory disease. And I think she has some exciting results. So that...
We have time for a few questions.